The envelope he handed to her was marked, Registered Airmail Special Delivery Personal. The return address said, Quentin Daniels, Utah Institute of Technology, Afton, Utah. Oh, thank you. The assistant manager noted that her voice went dropping toward a whisper, the polite disguise for a gasp. He noted that she stood looking down at the sender's name much longer than was necessary. So he repeated his good wishes and departed. She was tearing the envelope open as she walked toward Reardon, and she stopped in the middle of the room to read the letter. It was typewritten on thin paper. He could see the black rectangles of the paragraphs through the transparent sheets, and he could see her face as she read them. He expected it by the time he saw her come to the end. She leaped to the telephone. He heard the violent whirl of the dial and her voice saying with trembling urgency, Long distance, please. Operator, get me the Utah Institute of Technology at Afton, Utah. He asked, approaching, What is it? She extended the letter, not looking at him, her eyes fixed on the telephone as if she could force it to answer. The letter said, Dear Miss Taggart, I fought it out for 3 weeks. I did not want to do it. I know how this will hit you, and I know every argument you could offer me, because I've used them all against myself. But this is to tell you that I'm quitting. I cannot work under the terms of Directive 10-289, though not for the reasons its perpetrators intended. I know that their abolition of all scientific research does not mean a damn to you or me, and that you would want me to continue. But I have to quit, because I do not wish to succeed any longer. I do not wish to work in a world that regards me as a slave. I do not wish to be of any value to people. If I succeeded in rebuilding the motor, I would not let you place it in their service. I would not take it upon my conscience that anything produced by my mind should be used to bring them comfort. I know that if we succeed, they will be only too eager to expropriate the motor, and for the sake of that prospect, we have to accept the position of criminals, you and I, and live under the threat of being arrested at any moment at their whim. And this is the thing that I cannot take, even were I able to take all the rest, that in order to give them an inestimable benefit, we should be made martyrs to the men who but for us could not have conceived of it. I might have forgiven the rest, but when I think of this, I say, may they be damned. I will see them all die of starvation, myself included, rather than forgive them for this or permit it. To tell you the full truth, I want to succeed, to solve the secret of the motor as much as ever. So I shall continue to work on it for my own sole pleasure and for as long as I last. But if I solve it, it will remain my private secret. I will not release it for any commercial use. Therefore, I cannot take your money any longer. Commercialism is supposed to be despicable, so all those people should truly approve of my decision, and I'm tired of helping those who despise me. I don't know how long I will last or what I will do in the future. For the moment, I intend to remain in my job at this institute. But if any of its trustees or receivers should remind me that I'm now legally forbidden to cease being a janitor, I will quit. You had given me my greatest chance, and if I'm now giving you a painful blow, perhaps I should ask you to forgive me. I think that you love your work as much as I loved mine. So you will know that my decision was not easy to make, but that I had to make it. It is a strange feeling, writing this letter. I do not intend to die, but I'm giving up the world, and this feels like the letter of a suicide. So I want to say that of all the people I've known, you are the only person I regret leaving behind. Sincerely yours, Quentin Daniels. When he looked up from the letter, he heard her saying, as he had heard her through the words of the typewritten lines, her voice rising closer to despair each time, Keep ringing, operator. Please, keep ringing. What can you tell him? He asked. There are no arguments to offer. I won't have a chance to tell him. He's gone by now. It was a week ago. I'm sure he's gone. They've got him. Who got him? Yes, operator, I'll hold the line. Keep trying. What would you tell him if he answered? I'd beg him to go on taking my money with no strings attached, no conditions, just so he'll have the means to continue. I'll promise him that if we're still in a looter's world, when and if he succeeds, I won't ask him to give me the motor or even to tell me its secret. But if by that time we're free... She stopped. If we're free. All I want from him now is that he doesn't give up and vanish like all those others. I don't want to let them get him. If it's not too late... Oh, God, I don't want them to get him. Yes, operator, keep ringing. What good will it do us, even if he continues to work? That's all I'll beg him to do, just to continue. Maybe we'll never get a chance to use the motor in the future, but I want to know that somewhere in the world there's still a great brain at work on a great attempt, and that we still have a chance at a future. If that motor is abandoned again, then there's nothing but Starnesville ahead of us. Yes, I know. She held the receiver pressed to her ear, her arms stiff with the effort not to tremble. She waited, and he heard in the silence the futile clicking of the unanswered call. "He's gone," she said. "They got him. A week is much longer than they need. I don't know how they learn when the time is right, but this," she pointed at the letter, "this was their time, and they wouldn't have missed it." "Who?" "The destroyer's agents." "Are you beginning to think that they really exist?"
"Yes."
"Are you serious?"
"I am. I've met one of them."
"Who?"
"I'll tell you later. I don't know who their leader is, but I'm going to find out one of these days. I'm going to find out. I'll be damned if I let them."
She broke off on a gasp. He saw the change in her face the moment before he heard the click of a distant receiver being lifted, and the sound of a man's voice saying across the wire, "Hello?
Daniels, is that you? You're alive? You're still there?"
"Why, yes. Is this you, Miss Taggart? What's the matter?"
I thought you were gone."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I just heard the phone ringing. I was out in the back lot gathering carrots."
"Carrots?"
She was laughing with hysterical relief. "I have my own vegetable patch out there. Used to be the Institute's parking lot." "Are you calling from New York, Miss Taggart?"
"Yes, I just received your letter just now. I had been away."
"Oh." There was a pause. Then he said quietly, "There's really nothing more to be said about it, Miss Taggart."
"Tell me, are you going away?"
"No."
"You're not planning to go?"
"No." "Where?"
"Do you intend to remain at the Institute?"
"Yes."
"For how long? Indefinitely?"
"Yes, as far as I know."
"Has anyone approached you?"
"About what?"
"About leaving."
"No."
"Who?"
"Listen, Daniels, I won't try to discuss your letter over the phone, but I must speak to you. I'm coming to see you. I'll get there as fast as I can." "I don't want you to do that, Miss Taggart. I don't want you to go to such an effort when it's useless."
"Give me a chance, won't you? You don't have to promise to change your mind. You don't have to commit yourself to anything. Only to give me a hearing. If I want to come, it's my risk. I'm taking it. There are things I want to say to you. I'm asking you only for the chance to say them."
"You know that I will always give you that chance, Miss Taggart."
"I'm leaving for Utah at once, tonight. But there's one thing I want you to promise me. Will you promise to wait for me? Will you promise to be there when I arrive?"
"Why, of course, Miss Taggart, unless I die or something happens outside my power. But I don't expect it to happen."
"Unless you die, you will wait for me no matter what happens?"
"Of course."
"Do you give me your word that you'll wait?"
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
"Thank you. Good night."
"Good night, Miss Taggart."
She pressed the receiver down and picked it up again in the same sweep of her hand and rapidly dialed a number.
"Eddie, have them hold the Comet for me. Yes, tonight's Comet. Give orders to have my car attached, then come here to my place at once."
She glanced at her watch.
"It's 8:12. I have an hour to make it. I don't think I'll hold them up too long. I'll talk to you while I pack."
She hung up and turned to Reardon. "Tonight," he said,
"I have to."
"I guess so. Don't you have to go to Colorado anyway?"
"Yes, I intended to leave tomorrow night, but I think Eddie can manage to take care of my office, and I'd better start now. It takes 3 days," she remembered.
"It will now take 5 days to reach Utah.
I have to go by train. There are people I have to see on the line. This can't be delayed either."
"How long will you stay in Colorado?"
"Hard to tell."
"Wire me when you get there, will you? If it looks as if it's going to be long, I'll join you there."
This was the only expression he could give to the words he had desperately wished to say to her, had waited for, had come here to say, and now wished to pronounce more than ever, but knew that it must not be said tonight. She knew, by a faint, solemn stress in the tone of his voice, that this was his acceptance of her confession, his surrender, his forgiveness. She asked, "Can you leave the mills?"
"It will take me a few days to arrange, but I can."
He knew what her words were admitting, acknowledging, and forgiving him. When she said, "Hank, why don't you meet me in Colorado in a week? If you fly your plane, we'll both get there at the same time, and then we'll come back together." "All right, dearest."